Our reading comes to us from the biography of Steve Jobs. It was written by Walter Isaacson. One sunny afternoon when he wasn't feeling well, Jobs sat in the garden behind his house and reflected on death. He talked about his experiences in India almost four decades earlier, his study of Buddhism and his views on reincarnation and spiritual transcendence. "I'm about 50-50 on believing in God," he said. "For most of my life, I've felt that there must be more to our existence than meets the eye." He admitted that as he faced death, he might be overestimating the odds out of a desire to believe in an afterlife. "I like to think that something survives after you die," he said. "It's strange to think you accumulate all this experience and maybe a little wisdom, and it all just goes away. So I really want to believe that something survives, that maybe your consciousness endures." He fell silent for a very long time. But on the other hand, perhaps it's like an on-off switch. Click, and you're gone. Then he paused again and smiled slightly. Maybe that's why I never like to put on-off switches on Apple devices.
How did we get here? In 1944, there were just over 1 million atheists in the United States. Now there are 32 million. How did we get here? Don't get me wrong, I'm not upset about this. I'm mostly curious, because the change is cataclysmic. While estimates vary vastly, most of them find that about 91% of the world has some sort of belief in God. If you look at the geographic breakdown, the majority of convinced atheists live in two countries, China and Russia, because, well, communism. How did we get here? Or maybe phrased differently, why, as Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor asks, why was it virtually impossible not to believe in God in, say, 1500 in our Western society? Well, in 2017, many of us find this not only easy, but even inescapable. What happened in the last 517 years that would so fundamentally alter the very horizons of what could be imagined? A world without God. Being good without God. It's not that people don't believe in God, though, in 2017. In fact, in most Western countries, the vast majority of people do. Or even that maybe in 1500 there were not individuals who lived lives of convinced atheism. What Taylor is getting at in his question is, what makes atheism a viable option in the marketplace of beliefs now, in ways that it didn't seem possible before? I grew up an atheist. Not because anyone told me to be one. I knew other people who believed in God, but my pretty liberal secular household didn't pressure me to believe one way or the other. And so, left to my own devices, I sort of defaulted to atheism. That experience of defaulting to atheism, this is the core of what Charles Taylor's life work has been about, trying to understand what makes it possible for in this part of human existence, a young child could default to atheism. Is this a fixture of our secular age, this word secular that religious fundamentalists are terrified of? But it's a very slippery word, isn't it? What exactly does secular mean? Now, there are many different definitions of it. In some situations, secular is the counterpart to the sacred. In this definition, the priests tend to the secular work, while the bakers, butchers, and candlestick makers carry out the rest, right? Sacred versus profane. In other senses, though, secular has this other meaning. It sort of means a-religious, non-religious, not being biased by religious belief or practice. Western democracies attempt to be secular not by privileging any specific religion, by creating a neutral and unbiased, objective public square. And as a default atheist, I began to absorb what I would later learn was a subtraction theory of secularization. It'd be pretty annoying if I called it that when I was a young child, but I just sort of absorbed it, and maybe you did too. It's this story in our society that once upon a time, humans believed in fairies and gods and demons, but then somehow we became rational, and we understood through science what we attributed to spirits, and the world became disenchanted, leaving only nature and scientific truth. Reason replaced God. Fact replaced superstition. Explanations undid stories of the supernatural, if only we just knew enough, right? And as science advanced, the world of religion retreated. I imbibed this story that Western society, at least, that atheism was winning the survival of the fittest of belief systems, that it was only natural that soon, as soon as we knew just a bit more, belief in God would go away. This made my atheism rather smug and superior, I will tell you. And yet, while I accepted all of that, I was haunted by God, haunted by religion. I wrestled with those very human existential questions. Is this really it? Do we really just decompose when we die? Didn't exactly like the answers I came up with. When I would drive past a church as a child, I would always wonder, what do they do in there? What do they know that I don't? How can people believe such make-belief? And then at another gut level, I felt this sinking feeling, I wish I could believe, but I couldn't bring myself. I couldn't bring myself to believe in God or in heaven or any of the fantastical stories, even though I secretly hoped that I was wrong, secretly hoped that I just had some sort of defective God antenna. To paraphrase Julian Barnes, I didn't believe in God, but I missed him. I had stumbled right into the emotional heart of what Charles Taylor calls the secular age. For Taylor, the secular doesn't denote the profane or the a-religious. The secular represents the age of contested belief, where religious belief is no longer axiomatic, that no matter your beliefs, it is possible for you to imagine believing in God, that no matter your beliefs, it's possible for you to imagine not believing in God, that no matter your beliefs about God, you can imagine yourself finding yourself between the poles of atheism and theism. It's possible, right? This experience of the secular underpins the excerpt from Steve Jobs' biography that Gretchen read, and it is at the heart of this passage from Paul Eli's book, The Life That You Save May Be Your Own. He writes, "We are all skeptics now, believer and unbeliever alike. There is no one true faith evident at all times and places. Every religion is one amongst many. The clear lines of any orthodoxy are made crooked by our experience, are complicated by our lives. Believers and unbelievers are in the same predicament, thrown back onto themselves in complex circumstances, looking for signs. As every religious belief makes its claim somewhere between revelation and projection, between holiness and human frailty, the burden of proof has been changed. Indeed, the burden of belief for so long was upheld by society is now back on the believer, where it belongs." But describing what it is like here in this secular age doesn't exactly help us answer the question I posed at the beginning. Why was it virtually impossible not to believe in God 1,500 years ago or 500 years ago? But now many of us find it easy or inescapable. How did we get here? Now, the subtraction theory says that we already have our answer, right? We've just evolved out of our superstition. And the secular, the a-religious, the neutral, the objective world that we inhabit is the remainder from the equation existence minus God equals this. But I think this is too simple an explanation. In reality, our secular world was not created out of simple subtraction, but was an accomplishment, a product of new creative options, an entire reconfiguration of meaning that was fashioned by, and this may be a shocker, was fashioned by Western Christianity over the past 500 years. That paradoxically, one of the gifts of theism, at least Christian theism, was atheism. That as Christians evolved in their theology and faithful practice, they began to fundamentally change the very horizons of what was possible, what was believable, and in doing so, they not only found the door to a belief system that would not need nor want their God, they opened it. Said another way, Protestant Christianity created new ways of understanding the world that made it possible to find meaning, significant meaning, without God. Now, to understand all of that, we have to go back in time. We have to go back into the Middle Ages to understand the worldview that was operative about 1,500 years ago, or 500 years ago, in the year 1500.
Third service.
So in that medieval worldview, the natural world was constituted as a cosmos. Earthly events and actions inhabited divine attributes and meaning. Society itself was understood as grounded in a higher reality, that of God. That means that earthly kingdoms were grounded in heavenly kingdoms. One of the weird facts I remember from high school English class was that in Shakespeare's Macbeth, after the good King Duncan was killed by the evil Macbeth, there was this fascinating dialogue that occurred, describing the strange events in nature that happened the night of the murder. Here's a little excerpt. "And Duncan's horses, a thing most strange and certain, beauteous and swift, the minions of their race, turned wild in nature, broke their stalls, flung out, contending against obedience as they would make war with mankind. 'Tis said they ate each other. They did so, to thy amazement of mine eyes that looked upon it." So to translate, because Duncan's reign was divinely ordained, his murder was not just an upset to the political order, but upset the entire divine order of creation. And when you upset the entire divine order of creation, everything goes haywire. Horses that were domestic turn wild, and not only wild, they turn cannibalistic. I thought it was just a weird Shakespearean thing. In this pre-modern worldview, people lived in an enchanted world where they were always open and vulnerable to divine action. To be human was to be essentially open to the outside, open to blessing, open to curse, open to possession, open to grace. We were vulnerable from these outside divine powers. This was the time when demonic possession was a regular occurrence, not just something you saw on TV. Which is why people clamored to pull on spiritual armor, to just visit or touch the relics, these bodies and belongings of saints, or to receive the Eucharistic host to help ward off these evil powers. Rejecting God in that time was disavowing your only ally, was chancing yourself against the evil powers of the world without any divine backup. Before atheism would be possible, the world would have to be disenchanted. The power of things and the inherent significance of the world, which need to shift in location from being out there to being in here. Things couldn't have power over us. We had to have power over things. That way, if you didn't believe in God, you weren't going it alone. But that's not all that needed to happen. But because society's immunities and conceptions of the common good They required collective devotion, which means that turning heretical was not just a personal choice or private preference that may rise the ire of a relative over the Thanksgiving dinner table. It was actually an action that endangered everyone. So just becoming an atheist would transform society, because your heretical turn was breaking the agreement that society made with God. And if you broke the agreement that society made with God, guess what? Terrible things happened. And so all of your friends and neighbors and fellow townspeople were really keen to bring you back in line. So before atheism could be possible, we would have to transform our view of society, not as this seamless cloth in which we needed to be collectively devout to God, but we needed to transform it to be society as simply a collection of individuals, autonomous and self-sufficient. That salvation and grace had to become personal, privatized, and not held communally. For me, this understanding helps me understand why people back then reacted so violently to different beliefs, why we had witch trials and the Crusades and book burnings. But it also helps me understand why religious fundamentalists of our age are so against things like same-sex marriage. Because for me, same-sex marriage seems like a personal, individual choice. If you don't like gay marriage, as they say, don't get one. And yet, if you are living in a worldview in which God is requiring collective obedience, one person's breaking of the covenant signals collective damnation. But even if we got rid of that, we would still need to change one more thing. We had to go through a radical reconfiguration about the purpose of life, where in the pre-modern age, the purpose of life was fully located in the afterlife, which necessitated doing God's will here on earth. The individual and collective calculus was very clear back then. You could not just seek worldly pleasure because you felt like it, because that would endanger your soul. And so, for atheism to take root, the purpose of life would have to be broken open. It would have to be relocated from the afterlife to this life. So, to summarize all of those things I just said, for atheism to be possible and viable on a societal scale, the world would need to be disenchanted of its power. Things couldn't have power anymore. The common good need not require collective devotion. And finally, the purpose of life couldn't be located somewhere else. It had to be located here. And ironic as it may be, it was the reform movements within Christianity that created the conditions for these three things to happen. For Protestant Christianity was outraged by the way that Catholic Christianity created a two-tiered system in which monks and clergy were on the fast track to salvation, and the rest of us lesser people were just tagging along, maybe. And so the reform had this impulse, was to make everyone abide by the high standards of devotion that was once only taken up by the monastics. They didn't want this two-tiered system of Christianity. They wanted us all to abide by those standards. And this did a few things. First, it broke open the division between the sacred and the profane, because now ordinary domestic life was sanctified because everyone was required to serve God just like a monk or priest would. And secondly, it raised the expectations so high on everyone else, it started to open a rift. For if you imagine back at that time, if you were a lowly peasant, your contribution to the salvation of society was simply to, you know, give some money to the monastics. You were basically like outsourcing your salvation. You supported the monks who had the full-time work to save your soul, and you did most of your life. But now come these Protestants, and what do they say? Not only do you need to do your regular work, you also need to serve God full time, which starts to open up a rift. As the bar seems to be raised so high, people naturally seek another purpose. opening the possibility that maybe the purpose isn't so much about honoring God, about something that happens more in this life. But Protestant Christians like John Calvin weren't done then. Their final move was seeing the misdeeds of the Catholic Church being too great. They didn't want to leave any human in charge of any of it. And so they attempted to remove all power for salvation from human hands. They thought that if humans could touch it, it could be compromised, which led them to reject the center of religious life being rituals like the Eucharist or the power of relatic. Things couldn't have power because only God could have power. And paradoxically, this action, which aimed to protect humans and God, opened up the world for goodness and atheism to exist. What began as a movement to purify Christianity, this reform movement gave way to the conditions for atheism. Protestant Christianity disenchanted the world of powerful things and magic when it disavowed the sacraments. It opened the door to naturalism. The sacred began to leave the world, and in that vacuum, the world was no longer held in its power. What was once a divinely inspired order became, well, maybe just a human-created order. And so what Christians did at that time was they said, well, if this world isn't divinely inspired, maybe our role is to craft this world to be in God's image. And so God stopped being what underpins society, but started to become the clockmaker that started society or all of things, or became just the judger at the end to see how well we ordered everything. That's where Adam Smith and John Locke come to formulate their way of ordering human life, primarily upon human flourishing. Sure, there was lip service to God, but God began to take up this new, distant role. In his seminal piece, The Secular Age, Charles Taylor proposes that in the last 500 years, we've moved through two distinct stages before arriving at this moment in time. The first was that political order of the day was assumed to be divinely inspired. Kings, priests, and monks all had their role to play in God's world. The second was that movement, as that divine right of kings was challenged, it shifted emphasis. Now we were. The religious act was to construct political order in conformity to God. But then we arrived at our third age, the natural hop, skip, and a jump from the other two, that Taylor describes as the age of authenticity, an age in which the religious impulse fully embraces an individualistic notion, the romantic expressionist notion that each of us has our own way of realizing humanity, and that we are called out to live it, rather than conform to any model, or even reform society in our own particular image, so that religion became a spirituality mostly about what felt right to you. Sound familiar? But Taylor says that this radical transformation of society has left our age haunted. Before the breakdown of Christendom's worldview, encountering difference didn't pose a problem. Because if you are living with a general sense that being like someone who is different, whether that be a different religion or different race, is never an option for you, if you would never consider becoming another or a practitioner of another religion, or you couldn't see it would be even possible to be an atheist, when you encountered someone like that, it didn't really have an effect on you. But in our modern age, when the stranger starts to become more comprehensible, when the others who share different beliefs become more and more like me in everything else but their faith, in their activities, in their professions, in their opinions, in their tastes, then the issue of difference becomes more insistent. Because it starts to ask the question, why my way and not theirs? There is no difference left to make the shift preposterous or unimaginable between people who believe and people who don't. Living in this tension, in the wake of loss of the unified worldview, in the cross pressures of life, Taylor proposes that it leaves many of us with a feeling and a sense of loss, something that's hard to even put our fingers on, this vague sense that our actions, our goals, our accomplishments have lost an ultimate weight. an ultimate gravity. Or maybe that the sheer multitude of different beliefs that we encounter in our day-to-day life leave even the most committed theists and atheists with doubts. And while fundamentalists on all sides, be that militant atheists or fundamentalists of all religion, will react to this loss by doubling down on their own sides, telling us for sure that this is all there is, or I know there's much more. Most of us, no matter our beliefs about God, live somewhere in the middle now, for the first time in human existence, where doubt has become a companion, where the ultimate claims about truth are tempered by each of our perspective and experience. Because after all, atheism and theism, well, they're family, born of each other, made up of each other. Christianity gave birth to atheism as it tried to live its faithful Christianity out in the world. Unitarian Universalism in the past tried to be secular by not being religious. In the past few decades has begun to embrace a new way of being secular. Unitarian Universalism's embrace of secularity is how do we live in the beautiful tension of contested belief. I don't believe in God, I say to people when they ask me, but I experience God. I doubt way too much to believe, but experience and doubt can live together, especially in this age. Amen.